is Teachin' Books, a podcast all about the ways people teach, learn, and work with literature. I'm Jessica McDonald, and today's episode is going to be a little bit different from the usual Teachin' Books format. So let me tell you what's going on. Near the end of 2020 last year, I was invited by my mentor and friend, Wendy Roy, to join her to launch her newest book, the next installment, Serials, Sequels, and Adaptations of Nellie L. McClung, L.M. Montgomery, and Maisel de la Roche. And that book launch and the resulting conversations about the book and the book writing process are what today's episode is going to feature and focus on. First, let me tell you a little bit about Wendy. Wendy Roy is a professor of Canadian literature at the University of Saskatchewan who works on issues of gender and culture in Canadian women's writing. Along with the next installment, her publications include the 2005 monograph, Maps of Difference, Canada, Women, and Travel, the 2012 collection, Listening Up, Writing Down, and Looking Beyond, Interfaces of the Oral, Written, and Visual, co-edited with Susan Gingell, and essays on a number of Canadian writers. Her current Shirk-funded research project, Women of the Apocalypse, Writing the End of the World in Canada, focuses on apocalyptic and dystopian writing by Canadian women from the past 50 years. So the next installment, her most recent book, was published by Wilfrid Laurier University Press in 2019. But because of the COVID-19 pandemic, Wendy's book launch, which was, I believe, scheduled for March 2020, was postponed until December 10th, 2020. And on that day, we held it virtually over Zoom. I'm not going to say much about the actual book here in this intro because the title gives you the gist of it, and also because you'll get a really detailed sense of it, I think, through the three pieces of the episode that I've assembled together in this podcast. So let me tell you what those three pieces are. In the first, you'll hear Wendy reading from the introduction of her book, an abridged sort of condensed version of the intro. Following that, you'll hear another kind of abridged version of the Q&A that happened right at the launch itself on December 10th, 2020. And that's where attendees asked Wendy questions about her book. And then lastly, following that, you'll hear a short debriefing discussion that Wendy and I had a couple months after the launch, just to sort of zoom out and think about the process of researching, writing, and publishing an academic book. That's what we wanted to do in that conversation. What makes this episode, I think, both different from some of the other Teachin' Books episodes so far, but also uniquely valuable in that difference, is that it showcases how archival work, writing, and publishing are also teaching and learning contexts, even if they aren't really formally or in the strictest ways that we might think of teaching and learning. And when I was prepping for this episode, I was sort of thinking of why and how that is. And I think there's at least three reasons for that. The first is because for those of us who work in academia, we know that there is an inevitable overlap between research, teaching, administrative work, supervision and mentorship, and all sorts of other professional and personal activities. It's hard to separate teaching and learning from research if you're working in a position where research and teaching are both involved. The second reason is because these kinds of activities, archival work, writing, publishing, they often involve collaboration or at least relationships that can fall into teaching and learning categories, like hiring RAs and working with them, or working with peer reviewers and librarians and editors and publishers. These are all relationships that can have at their core processes that look like teaching and learning. And that's something that Wendy gets into in the episode. And lastly, the process of preparing a book for publication, an academic book for publication, also often means that the individual researcher goes through their own learning or growth process along the way. And so it is, you know, writing and researching and going into the archives can be really instructive in ways that are similar to what happens in more formal teaching and learning contexts. And again, that's something that Wendy actually speaks to later in this episode. It was my pleasure to help Wendy launch her book and to speak with her afterward about the book preparation process for this podcast, especially because Wendy has been a teaching and learning and research mentor for me for, it turns out, over a decade, because I just checked into that to make sure I knew the timeline. I'm pretty certain that a lot of the ideas that I've developed about teaching and that you probably hear about on this podcast are quite significantly shaped by Wendy and by her, you know, her influence on me over the years. So, if you are ready, let's first hear Wendy's reading from the introduction of her book, and then a portion of the Q&A from the book launch of the next installment. Then I'll check back in with you.
What happens next? Early 20th century Canadian authors Nellie L. McClung, Ellen Montgomery, and Maisa de la Roche were each asked that question by their readers, their publishers, and themselves. Separately, they answered in the same way, by engaging in the cultural phenomenon of the continuing story through serials, sequels, and adaptations. These varying modes of continuation are intimately connected to and influence one another as part of a cultural and material continuum. When novels are serialized, standard practice in early 20th century publishing, writers, readers, and publishers recognize the possibility for further continuing the story through sequelization. Novels that have sequels, in turn, are prime candidates for adaptation to film or television, since books that continue character stories often provide conclusions to vocation and courtship plots, essential to success in new media of adaptation. But the process of continuing the story through serialization, sequelization, or adaptation fundamentally changes the ways in which the story is received and, ultimately, how it can be further continued. The next installment, Serials, Sequels, and Adaptations of Nellie L. McClung, Ellen Montgomery, and Maisa de la Roche, asks these questions. What is the relationship between serialization of stories in magazines and newspapers and the production of sequel novels? Do similar forces propel the works, adaptation for popular media such as film and television? And what might the varying manifestations of continuing stories have to tell researchers, not just about changing reading and viewing practices, but also about changing social and political relations? These three authors form a natural comparative constellation. All were born in rural Canada in the same decade of the 19th century. McClung in Ontario in 1873, moving to Manitoba when she was seven. Montgomery in Prince Edward Island in 1874. And de la Roche in Ontario in 1879. All published their first books, which featured children, when they were in their 30s or 40s. But all had begun their literary careers years earlier by selling short stories by mail to North American magazines, sometimes the same ones. For example, they all published stories in the Toronto-based Canadian magazine. Serialized novels by the three authors appeared in some of the same newspapers that had already published their short stories, before, at the same time as, or within a year of their publication as books, the three originary novels, McClung's 1908 Sowing Seeds and Danny, Montgomery's 1908 Anne of Green Gables, and de la Roche's 1927 Jalna, were printed in installments in North American newspapers and magazines. McClung's and Montgomery's appeared in high-end American women's magazines, Women's Home Companion and The Housewife, with airy typesetting, discreet advertisements, and original illustrations. They also appeared in Canadian newspapers for rural audiences, the Norwest Farmer and the Family Herald and Weekly Star, in long columns of crowded type with intrusive, unrelated advertising and with no illustrations. While de la Roche's early serialized novels were published in the literary and political Atlantic Monthly magazine in a non-illustrated book-like format. Her later serials appeared beautifully and really interestingly illustrated in more popular general interest in women's magazines such as Chatelaine and Redbook. The reader's experiences of these novels in book form or in installments in very different periodicals was thus widely variant, spread out over days, weeks, or months, published in their entirety or heavily edited for length, divided into carefully planned or arbitrary sections, laid out in artistic or more prosaic formats, and accompanied by illustrations or only by advertisements and news stories. The practice of serialization helped to stimulate a taste for continuing stories that these authors, like others, fulfilled through sequels. The expectation that serialized novels would be followed by sequels became even more insistent when the books like Montgomery's were family-oriented and were published by a company that featured children's series, or like De La Roche's were published as a result of a win in a magazine literary contest. The three writers fulfilled these expectations, with Montgomery producing a total of 8 novels about Anne, McClung writing 3 about Pearl, and De La Roche 16 about the White Oak family of Jalna. With sequel publication, the authors and publishers negotiated similar issues to those of serial publication, such as whether and how the work should be illustrated, but also problems related to titling and book cover design, which usually emphasize links with the earlier published novels. Sequel novels are written, published, and read for many reasons. These include a desire by readers for repetition, but with difference, a wish by the author to explore in more detail a character or situation from a previous work, and a need expressed by the author or publisher to continue an economically successful venture. Even if readers are somewhat disappointed in sequels, they may still enjoy them and persist in demanding more. Critics, however, are a different story. While the originary books by McClung, Montgomery, and De La Roche were all well received by critics as well as readers, as their sequels proliferated and as McClung turned to political activism and away from the writing of fiction, the literary value of their works was aggressively downgraded, often characterized as pandering to mediocre taste. Adaptations of the books to other media also had an effect on the reception of the stories and the production of further installments. While McClung and Montgomery published their first novels toward the beginning of the silent movie era, De La Roche's Jalna came out the year Talking Pictures first appeared. Montgomery's and De La Roche's books were adapted multiple times for film and television, sometimes to the author's dismay. Montgomery, because she received no compensation for these adaptations, and De La Roche because she wanted more control over how her works were interpreted. But while McClung's novels were adapted for temperance recitations, they were never adapted for film or television. And perhaps because of this omission, McClung's fiction has been more or less forgotten. The sequels written by all three authors extend the characters' life stories in ways that would potentially help with adaptation. Both the 1919 and 1934 movie versions of Anne of Green Gables end in Anne's engagement to Gilbert, which of course didn't happen until the conclusion to the third novel. While the 1935 film Jalna ends with the implied union of Elaine and Rennie, which did not take place until the next book in the sequence. My study of McClung suggests that even if sequel novels continue the bildung of a main character, if they are not recognized as forming a continuing unit, as happened with the Pearlie Watson trilogy because of titling and extended separation and publication dates, the originary work may not be a candidate for full adaptation. Would things have been different had McClung's novels featured Pearl in their titles, as Montgomery's featured Anne? Would they have been adapted into a silent film that concluded with her romantic attachment to Dr. Clay while omitting her more unusual interest in suffragism? And would today's viewers now be watching an updated version of Pearl's story on Netflix that brings in contemporary concerns about child labor while re-engaging with McClung's commitments to gender equality, similar to what happened in the latest adaptation of Anne of Green Gables? While it's obvious that adaptations are based on the originary text, What's less acknowledged is that they have an irreversible effect on how that text is subsequently interpreted. For example, adaptation of novels by Montgomery and de la Roche in places such as Japan and France moved these works into the international arena more definitively than did translation alone. Adaptations also encouraged the authors to write more sequels. For Montgomery, the 1934 film adaptation, Anne of Green Gables, demonstrated continuing public enthusiasm for the story and thus helped inspire her to write two more Anne books, for which she actively pursued film rights. One final note about how encounters with stories determine our interpretations of them. I first read Anne of Green Gables when I was a child, but as a young adult saw the 1985 television movie as another equally enjoyable incarnation of the story. I encountered de la Roche's Jalna as a teenager in the form of a CBC television miniseries that my mother, who had read Jalna, well, I had not, was watching and then critiquing. And I then read with guilty pleasure de la Roche's 1949 governess novel, Mary Wakefield. McClung's Sowing Seeds in Dani I came to only as an adult, first studying her political and autobiographical writing and becoming intrigued by references in these to her fiction. My responses to these literary works are irretrievably connected to the ways I encountered them. Jalna's Rennie, for example, will always appear to me to resemble the actor who played him in the 1972 miniseries. While I still retain my childhood imagined picture of Anne, the image of lovable Canadian actor Megan Follows, who played her in the 1985 miniseries, is superimposed like a shadow. And my response to McClung's third novel, Purple Springs, is colored by her description of her own experiences in pursuit of votes for women, outlined in the second volume of her autobiography. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Cool. So thank you so much for doing that reading. And also thank you for writing this book. Because as I told you sort of off camera, I just was so impressed by it. And so it was just such a richly filled book with so much detail and so much research. And that's actually part of the first question I wanted to ask you was sort of all of the research that you did, including the archival research. You know, you had personal letters that you looked at, advertisements, journals and newspapers, scholarship, the novels themselves, financial records, all of this like research that you did that's so beautifully woven into the book. What were the biggest obstacles or the challenges that you faced in sort of managing all that research?
All that was the reason it took 10 years to write the book because, or put the book together, because there really was a lot. And recently I was involved in a dissertation defense of Marcel Cosman from the University of Alberta. And she used a term paranoid archive that I thought really exemplified exactly the sort of work that I do as well as the sort of work that she does. And I think what she meant, and I agree, is that you're obsessively researching. You're going from one hint or link to another, you know, a reference to something that you find somewhere, then you find a reference to somewhere else. And so you're doing all this archival research, and yet you know you're missing things. There are all sorts of things out there that you know are out there that you'll never, ever be able to find, but someone else will find them. So that's why in my preface, I said, this is a work in progress and someone else is going to find out some new things that I wasn't able to find out. I also want to say that I couldn't have done this without a lot of help. So I had help from my research assistants. I think a couple of them are here, Kayla and Mabiana, and they helped a lot with doing things like looking through microfilms. There were also a lot of people in archives that helped me. There were also people like Izumi. She's here, I think. She really helped me in terms of getting in contact with people in Japan because I was having trouble having them answer my emails. And so she helped with that. And then I was also helped by a lot of the scholars who had already done research on Montgomery, de la Roche, and McClung. And so their work sort of provided basis. And they include people, I think, who are here today, like Ben Lefebvre, and like Maceo Dean and Cecily Devereaux. I think maybe the most challenging thing was getting access to the materials because some of the archives allowed me to photograph materials and some of them didn't. I just had to take notes and they would allow a little bit of photocopying. They would do the photocopying. So what would happen is I would get home and not have, you know, something that was crucial and have to somehow go back or get someone to do the research for me. Or I got home and I had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of photos, way too many. And I'd have to sort of figure out which ones were important. And but I say, I think the biggest challenge was putting it all together because it felt like a jigsaw puzzle, like a really big jigsaw puzzle with all these parts that had to be put together. And even though, even if I had good notes, but I still had to keep a lot in my head so that I would be able to put the pieces together. And sometimes they were amazing. For example, I was reading a contract, McClung's contract, and the date that it was put out was April 22nd, 1907. And I thought, that's a familiar date. April 22nd, 1907. That's exactly the same day that Montgomery's contract for her first book was drawn up.
Yeah, I was completely thinking of that detail. Like, that's exactly the kind of thing that there's so much of in the book. And that's both what makes it a super valuable resource, I think, is those facts, that information, that detail, that research that you had to synthesize so beautifully. It makes it a really good resource, but it also just makes it a really interesting book to read, because those are the kinds of facts that keep you know, certainly general readers, you know, I work in contemporary Canadian literature, so these aren't authors that I generally study, but it's the kind of thing that keeps it so lively is those facts. And that actually brings me to my second question I had here, which was about sort of the facts and the information that you have put in this book. I was wondering if you would share with us one or two kind of more interesting facts that you found about each of the authors, because there's so much in the book. I just want to make sure people hear a couple of them.
Yeah, and I'll maybe later be able to talk about the fact that there's probably still too much detail. So with McClung, one of the things that I realized as I was doing my research was that the titles of her books were a huge problem. And I don't think I'd realized that ahead of time. She wrote three connected novels, and they were quite episodic. You know, if you had to say who was the protagonist, you'd say Pearlie Watson. But the book titles didn't indicate that, and they didn't because of the first novel. So the first novel, she went back and forth with her publishers a lot of times about what to call it. And they ended up calling it the same title as the short story that had originated the novel. They called it Sowing Seeds in Danny. So, like, what seeds? Who's Danny, or where is Danny? And if you know the short story, you will know, which is the first chapter of the novel, you'll know that Danny is Pearl's little brother. And the seeds are seeds of being a good person that another character wants to sow in Danny. But Pearlie sows the seeds of Christian charity in that person. Well, so calling the book Sowing Seeds in Danny would be like calling Anne of Green Gables Marilla Learns Something. I have to say Montgomery and De La Roche really both were, they really resisted the idea of having to always have Anne in the title or always having Jolner or White Oaks in the title. But it really did help them to be seen as a unit or as a continuing story. Whereas if you have a book called Sowing Seeds in Danny, then the next one is called something else like Second Chance. And the third one is called Purple Springs. And people don't make that connection. So that's the most interesting thing I think I learned. It was about McClung, but it was related to the other two authors. And I started to think, maybe this is, it's not just because her books were perceived as sentimental or didactic that they weren't adapted. Maybe it was because they weren't seen as a unit that could have been adapted together. So that was for McClung. For Montgomery, there's been a lot of research done on Montgomery. So really, there weren't as many new things that I learned from that research. But I did learn some things about the serialization of her books, not just the Anne books, but her other books as well. And one of the things I learned was the different ways in which they were presented, the different sort of publications, but also things like the illustrator for the Pittsburgh Gazette used the illustrations from the book, but he redrew them and put his own or her own name at the bottom. So that was interesting to see that kind of representation of somebody else's illustration as his own. That was interesting. And I was also interested in the way in the early television adaptations, they usually didn't keep copies of them. They were seen as ephemeral. But I was able to find some scripts in the BBC print archives. For De La Roche, I think maybe the most interesting thing that I learned was that she was really one of the first people who really made use of the prequel imperative. There have been lots of authors who did sequels, but only a few, like I think Arthur Conan Doyle and one or two others, who did prequels, who went back and told the story of the same characters earlier. And I noticed, I realized how unusual it was when I was reading first her publisher's reactions. They were freaked out. Like, what are you doing here? And then the reviewers who said, wow, this is really interesting. I mean, this is great. We get to see these characters in a different kind of way. And isn't it interesting that she's doing this and she can continue going back and forth? Because she did sequels and prequels and sequels and prequels over and over and over again. That was her pattern. I was also interested with Delaroche in the adaptation in France, because I hadn't realized how popular her work was in France until I read some interviews of the people, the French actors who had been in the French miniseries in 1994. Danielle Darrow, who played the old grandma Adeline, she said, my friends and I, we read them all the time, so it's great for me to be playing one of the characters in 1994. So that was one of the things that I learned that I thought was really interesting.
I feel like all of the facts that you just gave give a really good representation of the breadth of the work that you do in this book. Because, I mean, I was just kind of writing down as you were talking, but you talked about titles, illustration, paratext, and adaptation in France. So a different cultural context or a different national context. There's just so much breadth as well as depth in this book. And so I'm glad that your answer highlighted that, because it's true. You were talking about how the authors respond to what their publishers wanted, or the pressures of publishing and the pressures of writing. And I'm kind of curious, just from a meta perspective, you're also a writer. And I'm wondering, in the process of writing and editing and publishing this book, what helpful advice did you get, or how did you respond to that advice?
Thank you. Yes, I did get good advice. I had the pleasure of having my manuscript read by a couple of readers twice, and they gave me some good advice. I think the main good advice that they gave me was, you have too much detail in this book, Wendy. You're just bogged down in archival bits and pieces, because I found it so interesting, and I had to step back and realize there were too many details and the argument was being lost in all of the detail. But I didn't want to get rid of all of it. I did smooth it out, and I put quite a bit of it in footnotes. And I did take out a lot of it that I realized, you know, readers don't need to know every review of the books. They just need a sort of a representative sample. And I did get some advice that I didn't take from the readers. One of them advised me to change the structure of the book. I talk about McClung's serial sequels and adaptations, then Montgomery's, and then Delaroche's. And they wanted me to take it apart and do all the serials, all the sequels, and then all the adaptations. The sort of the core of the argument is that there's a continuum, that the serials influence the sequels, which influence the adaptations. In order to see that trajectory, you actually have to see what happens to McClung's work through all those three parts, and then Montgomery's, and then Delaroche's. So I successfully made that argument, and I didn't change the structure of the book, but I did take out some repetition.
Great. It's so nice to hear about that from just like the perspective of an emerging scholar who is thinking about responding to feedback and how to respond to feedback appropriately and respectfully. So it's really nice to hear about the ways that you did that for this book, because I know how the end product turned out and it gives me hope for myself. So I actually think we already have some questions starting in the Q&A, and it's about that time anyways. So Lisa Vargo is asking, hello, Wendy. And she says, it sounds like a fascinating book. Couple of questions, you can choose which one you like. I'm wondering if, at least in the case of Montgomery, who simultaneously published in different venues across different countries, are there differences in the texts? This does seem to be the case with some writers. And a second question, with respect to what you didn't find, though it does seem like you discovered quite a few things, what questions are you left with? What is an example of something that remains to be discovered? Both of those are so good.
Oh, sure, they are. And Lisa, I'll try and answer both of them. There were differences in this text in the way that they were serialized and the way that they appeared in volume form. And mostly the serializations were shortened. And so, for example, some of the serializations, especially the first one in The Housewife, took out a lot of sort of the descriptions of Anne's imagination. Now, I'm going to actually talk a little bit about Delaroche, because, in fact, her work was, they were always edited either lightly or quite heavily to appear in the serials. And there was one really interesting discrepancy in one of the novels in which she's the text, the copy text that was used by the magazine included a final chapter that her four publishers had decided should go, with her American, Canadian, and British publishers. So it's not in the book. The only way you can see how she originally intended to end the novel is by reading that serial. I think it was in Redbook. The second question, well, I know there are lots of serials out there that I haven't discovered.
I noticed that, of course, in the book, that there would be moments where you just had to lay it out there and say, we don't know, or we don't have access to this, or we don't know where this is. And I actually liked those moments of disclosure. Thank you, Lisa, and thank you for answering that. So Susan Gingell asks, did teaching the works of McClung, Montgomery, and De La Roche bear any relationship to the adaptation process?
Well, I have taught Montgomery and McClung in undergrad, just short works mostly. But I actually did teach a class about 6 years ago for graduate students. And it was a small grad class that was really on this research. And so that was wonderful to be able to get responses from grad students on what I was doing, because I already had it mostly researched and planned out. But also they came up with some interesting ideas that I hadn't really considered. Like, for example, we watched some of the adaptations together, and they were really quite clear. This is better than the original. Like, I would never have thought that, that this is better than the original, but they did. One of the students in the grad class, he had some interesting analyses of the Bildungsroman, the novel of development, the coming of age story. And he talked about one of the characters as the book as being successful because the Bildung, the coming of age, was unsuccessful. Adaptation, I guess there is an adaptation that goes on in how you teach. I mean, what happens with adaptation, of course, is that the adapter chooses what's important, emphasizes particular things, de-emphasizes other things. And that's exactly what you do as an instructor. You look at a text and you say, well, I can't talk about the whole thing, a novel or nine novels, but I can say, this is what I think is important. This is what I'm going to emphasize. And this is how it's connected to contemporary ideas, because that's also what adapters do. They look at the contemporary. They say, what would people that are, I'm adapting it right now, what would people right now be interested in? So yeah, that's a really great question.
I was going to say your answer, even before you got to the second part, already spoke to how works transform through the classroom in a way that's akin to adaptation. And I'm just like jumping out of my seat here because I've been thinking about things along the lines of this question for the podcast. So I'm just sort of like, yeah, yes, I love this question. I'll just say, I know Wendy has a couple of things to say just in the last minute here, but I just wanted to thank you, Wendy, for the honor of chatting with you today and for giving us such complex answers. I think that's one of the things that the book does too, is never really reduces these complex figures to simple narratives. So thank you so much for that.
That was, as you know by now, a recording from Wendy's book launch in December 2020, which I hope gave you a good sense of what her book, The Next Installment, is about, as well as a sense of some of the kind of behind-the-scenes processes that Wendy undertook in order to publish the book. And those behind-the-scenes sort of things, those are essentially what I wanted to follow up with Wendy about in this next and final part of the episode, which is our post-launch debriefing chat. In this chat, I asked Wendy to circle back around to some of the ways in which researching, writing, revising, publishing, etc., might be framed as forms of teaching and learning. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. So one of the first things that I wanted to ask you about, and I know that we've talked about a little bit before, was how writing this book, writing any academic book, often will sort of afford the opportunity for the book author to mentor or teach RAs, research assistants. And I know that you did have a few research assistants, or at least a couple, throughout the process of this writing this book. So I wanted to know if you could just tell the listeners a little bit more about your experiences working with or mentoring or maybe teaching, quote unquote, the RAs who worked with you for this book.
Yes, I actually had six RAs, I think, throughout the course of the project. Yeah, because it was quite a long project. It started with the SHRC application and went into actually publication of the book. And so, you know, as I found as I was doing the research, that research like this really is a collaborative process with your research assistants. So grad student research assistants help us forward our projects as well as their own. And that means that work with them involves teaching and mentoring, and that we learn from them as well as them learning from us. So for this project, I had hoped to take a research assistant with me to introduce them to work in archives in Ottawa or Prince Edward Island or Toronto or Victoria. And that work would have involved finding and reading through and making notes on relevant materials, such as letters between authors and their publishers or their fans, book manuscripts, financial and publication records, documents related to serialization and adaptation, all of the things that give us an insight into these writers and their writing revision and publication process. But this just didn't work out. I ended up not being able to take research assistants to archives. And in part, it was related to the fact that I was often putting together fairly complicated itineraries involving research in an archive and presentation of a paper at a conference and then research at another archive. And part of it was that the more I thought about it, the more I it seemed to me that there might be better ways for a research assistant to use their time. I mean, it would be great if someone was really interested in archival research, but I didn't have any research assistants that were really specifically interested in archival research. And sometimes it is a kind of a lonely, isolating kind of thing that you do in an archive. And it just seemed to me that it might be that their time might be better spent doing other things. So they actually did a lot that was really helpful to me. There was, and there was still really a lot for them to do. So one of my first RAs put together a really amazing bibliography and collection of academic essays on the three writers and on broader sort of theoretical and background and historical sort of issues. And it was organized in such a way, she just did it herself. She did this organization in a way that made it useful to me right up to the end of the publication and writing process. Another research assistant organized the notes and photographs that I brought back from the archives. So they were a little bit disorganized and she put them into an order that was really useful for me in finding things throughout my writing process. A third RA worked on reading through and transcribing texts on microfilm. So there were a lot of short stories that were only available on microfilm, often that we received through interlibrary loans. So another RA, I asked, I think actually that was the same RA, who went through pre-existing bibliographies of work, especially by Montgomery, to identify magazine material that had been serialized. Mm-hmm. So there were bibliographies that said, you know, she has this short story in this journalist short story in this journal. And sometimes it wasn't entirely clear which were serials. And sometimes it was, but she was able to go through and figure out which were serialized for me. So just toward the very end of the process, I had RA's fact check and quotation mm-hmm. check part of the manuscript. So you can see from my description that some of that work is more interesting than other work. But all of it is really important and all of it requires mentoring, mm-hmm. sometimes more mentoring, sometimes less mentoring. And sometimes it's just a matter of making it clear what the expectations are, you know, what we're hoping to get out from this and how it'll help the process along, how it'll help the research and writing. And sometimes it involved actually showing how to do things like this has to be presented in a specific way for it to be helpful to me. And other times it was asking students to figure things out for themselves. So at times they had to figure out things like how to run microfilm equipment. Like it's better for you to just go to the library and ask someone to show you how to do that mm-hmm. and make a scan than for me to spend time showing you how to do that. So you have to figure that out for yourselves. And I really found that some of the research assistants loved the processes that they were working on. there was one undergraduate RA who just thought that finding and copying magazine stories on microfilm was amazing. I think she knew about microfilm. So mm-hmm. it's such an old technology. So she just thought it was amazing that there were all these things still on microfilm. Mm-hmm. Others found some of the work, like quotation checking, tedious. And I can see it is quite tedious. But I think it's possible that for them to see that they can learn from all of these experiences. And not the least of what they're learning is that all these elements of the research writing and editorial process are crucial for the kind of work that we do in our discipline. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that's the most important aspect of mentoring with RAs, to demonstrate the importance of building up research incrementally, that we don't just mm-hmm. have it all at once, that we have to build it up, and also the importance of the attention to detail. Because what we say, what we write, can be undermined by faulty background research or errors in how we present it. And so we need to get an understanding that, no, it's all really important to the whole process of what we're presenting here. And then I just want to say by saying that while we mentor graduate student and undergraduate student research assistants, we actually also learn a lot from them as mm-hmm. well. It's not just what they bring to us in terms of the research, but it's also learning whether we're communicating clearly mm-hmm. and whether we're being collegial in our approach to research. I think we learn from RAs, from working with RAs.
Yeah, I think the last few things you said too are such a, like, you've brought together so many different tasks, so many different types of RAs that you've had, so many different, I guess, activities that you've gotten RAs to do underneath these kind of larger banners of mentorship and lessons about mentorship that I think folks will find useful. And I think especially I'm struck by the way that you put a lot of care, it seems, and attention into what tasks are appropriate for what RAs or where RAs should best spend their time or what kinds of it seems like you're attentive to the RA's needs and their the fact that their time is valuable as well as yours and that sort of thing. So I think that's something that I'm pulling away as like an important aspect of your mentorship from what I'm hearing from you. And also the fact that the logistics of RA-ships, like itineraries and travel and finances and all of that sort of thing, the material logistics of RA mentorships and RAing really inform what you can do in an RA supervisor relationship too. And I think that's just a larger reality of teaching and learning, is that the material logistics will always sort of inflect what we're able to do and will influence what we're able to do. But alongside that kind of collaborative learning and collaborative process of writing this book alongside RAs, I guess, I think of writing a book also as like an individual learning process, or that I assume, having never written a published book, but a dissertation, that there's a kind of, a kind of individual learning process involved on the author's side or from the author's perspective, either in doing archival work or in the act of writing itself. Like there must be some sort of learning trajectory that happens in those two acts. Like I said, either archival work or in the act of writing itself. So I just wanted to know if you could speak to how research and writing for this project were acts of learning for you, if you really imagine them to be that way.
Yes, I do. I do imagine them as acts of learning. The whole experience is all about learning. So you go into a project like this, one that involves archival research as well as looking at previously published scholarship and trying to fit it into your own work, not knowing what you're going to find. So the whole process is really about discovery. So you end up discovering an exchange of letters between the author and publisher that changes your idea about the motivating force behind sequels, for example. Or you discover that a novel was serialized in 4 magazines when previous researchers have said it was serialized in 3 mm-hmm. magazines. So there's an additional bit of information there that you can put into the mix. Or you discover that an image from an adaptation has been used on a subsequent book cover. So you think, okay, well, that adaptation affected how people received subsequent editions of that book, mm-hmm. even if they didn't see the adaptation. They now have an image of what the characters look like from the adaptation. So I felt like I was learning all sorts of things about all three aspects of my project as I was doing the research on it. I find really that a lot of discovery happens in both archival and microfilm research.
Mm.
And that's one of the reasons that I find it so appealing, that mm-hmm. that you can find things out that weren't there before in a text that was easily accessible.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you start writing, there's also a lot of learning that happens during that process as well. You know, I've never been the kind of writer who knows from the outset exactly what I'm going to say. I've always found that the act of writing itself enables me to make connections and conclusions that I hadn't started with mm-hmm. or hadn't made before I started. So with this project, though, because there was so much archival and, you know, research in old publications and research in microfilms, there seemed to be especially a lot of discovery and learning, because, you know, something would happen. I think I mentioned it in the launch that I would be typing out the date when one of the authors signed her first contract, and I'd suddenly realize that I'd typed exactly the same date as the previous author author in my previous chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would think, wow, I didn't notice that when I was actually doing the research, because it was months apart.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these connections that I think are important for the project came not just in the research, but in the writing process.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes they were things like that, really specific little bits of information, but sometimes it was understandings.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd come to a bigger understanding about things like how the novels were titled, mm-hmm. the effects that had on recognition by the readers of their place in a sequelization chain. And that meant that I could see eventually changes or differences in the way that they were adapted, or whether adapters even thought it was possible to adapt them
mm-hmm.
because of that. So kind of lots of longer kind of chains of information and chains of understanding of how things were put together became more clear to me during the writing process.
Mm-hmm. You do talk about this a little bit at the launch, which I know will be included in this episode, but could you talk a little bit more about your experiences around the process of responding to feedback?
Yeah, I do think that the process of peer review does really mirror in substantial ways what we do in the classroom, what we do in and out of the classroom with students, I think. So in the classroom, if we have staged assignments, which I often do, then we're providing feedback to students that challenges them to revise,
mm-hmm.
to think about what they've written, to what they've researched, and to learn from the feedback more about how to organize and present their ideas about, in particular for us, about works of literature. So we try to do the same, or I try to do the same for my own work. I try to be my own commentator and my own editor. But sometimes we need an outside eye to tell us what we're missing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what we thought that was clear, but it really isn't. And I think that's what peer review does at its best. I had some really excellent peer reviews of this manuscript that helped me to present my arguments in a more clear and logical way. I think in the launch, I mentioned that I resisted some of the suggestions, such as reorganizing the manuscript in a wholesale way. But what the comments did was they made me see that I hadn't made the shape of my overall argument clear enough to readers.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who are reading my manuscript are really intelligent, highly trained readers. And if they can't see the trajectory of the argument, then there's clearly some crucial linkages missing. So when I'm responding to student work, I hope that they're going to understand from my comments the same thing. That if I can't understand what they're trying to do, and I'm an instructor, I know the topic, I know the text really well. If I can't understand what they're trying to do, then they need to revise to make things more clear,
mm-hmm.
to make their ideas more clear, their research more connected. So that's one of the things that I see as a sort of a similarity there between what happened with my process of being reviewed and what happens with students. So similarly, you know, students give us feedback too through their evaluations of us. And I like to be able to, I hope I can step back and take student comments and evaluations and try and try and sort of winnow out the parts that I think are not as helpful, mm-hmm. but instead look at the parts that help me to see what's missing in the class, what needs to change in order for students to understand the overall trajectory of the course. Mm-hmm. That's what I hope to be able to take from, especially the midterm evaluations. I think those are really helpful. Yeah. And in the peer review of my actual manuscript, I did find it very helpful, especially, as I said, in helping me to think about what connections were not evident in the process. Now, I sometimes wonder whether we should have anonymous peer review. And that's something that I maybe won't get into here. But I found all the evaluations of my manuscript really helpful. But there have been times on essays where I haven't found the peer reviews as helpful. And I think it's because they were anonymous and the anonymous reviewer wasn't being as careful as they could have been in presenting ideas in a constructive way. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I do wonder whether, not making anonymous, the way we're not anonymous when we're instructors of a class, might make it a more valuable sort of feedback, because then as an instructor, you want to make sure that you're being kind to your students and that you're actually helping them to improve and not just crushing them. Mm-hmm. And I have had the experience when I was very new of having peer review that I thought was crushing. Mm-hmm. Because the person could be anonymous in what they said. And so that's one of the things that I maybe can't get into here, but I've thought about in terms of concept of peer review and how we do it in our discipline.
Oh, yeah. I actually think that's a really important topic that should probably come up on the podcast in different ways, even though this is a more teaching-focused podcast. It still applies because there's implications, ethical implications behind anonymous review, just as there are ethical implications behind review that's not anonymous, right? And putting the people back into review, putting the positionality back into how we review, putting our bodies back in, like actually making known our identities, can have advantages for sure. It can have, I mean, it's politically charged. It's a politically charged decision to do double blind peer review or not to do that, to do totally open peer review. There are important implications here that I think are really important for both this podcast and this episode and the writing of research and the reviewing of research and that sort of thing. And actually, it applies to something that I wrote down just a few minutes ago about what I'm taking from everything you've answered today so far, which is how much relationships, including relationships with peer reviewers that might be anonymous to you, but relationships and sort of collaborative work and collaboration seem to be a part of a single author academic book. Like, this is a book that in the end, I should say relationships are so much a part of all teaching and research, but this is a book that in the end, has your name on it ostensibly as a single author. By single author, I mean,
yes, I know what
you mean. You wrote it. Only you wrote, your name is on it. But there's so many people involved behind the scenes, the peer reviewers, the editors, the RAs that you've talked about. I think you even mentioned librarians that might have taught the RAs how to use microfilm. Like, relationships and collaboration are what I'm taking from our conversation today as sort of the back end or the really important foundations of research and of the book that you've written and of teaching as well.
I think that's true, but and I try to acknowledge that in the acknowledgements, but it's not enough. I mean, to say I couldn't have done this without the RAs, all of the other researchers that came before that did all this work that I based it on, started from, all the people in the archives that helped me find things, and the people in libraries that helped RAs learn how to do X or Y, and the editors of the book and the peer reviewers and mm-hmm. and the publisher. And yeah, it is a hugely collaborative process, even if it's just supposedly by one author, for sure.
Oh, yeah. And I think you did a really good job of situating, like drawing out those lineages of work and labor and people in the book launch, too, because at least in portions of the book launch, you kept on referring to all of the folks who you're indebted to. And the book launch in some ways was like a practice in public gratitude in a way that I think is really it has, again, ethical implications that are really important for how we do scholarship, like sort of removing the individual thinking academic from their lonely, isolated ivory tower and instead bringing your words brought you down into the community of people that have informed your labor and your research. So my last question for you was kind of twofold, I guess, but I wanted to ask what you are working on now, or rather what's next for you, especially given that I imagine the pandemic has possibly changed the way that you're doing research.
That's a good question. And what happens in our discipline is that our research overlaps. So that I was doing the last stages of the next installment. Serious Leakages and Adaptations, at the same time as I was starting on my new research project, which is on a different topic. And I see them as related, but other people might not. So my new research project is called Women of the Apocalypse, Writing the End of the World in Canada. And as it suggests by the title, it explores Canadian women's apocalyptic and dystopian fiction. So part of the project was a conference on speculative fiction in Canada that we had to postpone from last August because of the pandemic. But we've rescheduled it for this August, but I think it's going to have to be online. Mm-hmm. And so that has made, the pandemic has definitely made some changes to that part of what I proposed as my research, which was a kind of a collaborative getting together and talking about speculative fiction. Now, I think it's going to change that conference because it's going to make us talk more about pandemics in Canadian fiction. So that's an interesting part of it. The conference is called 2021 Vision Speculating on Literature and Film in Canada. Mm-hmm. And people can see details of it under the outreach tab in the Department of English at the U of S homepage. That, as I said, that project, people might not see it as very connected to my last one, but I see them all as connected. All that project, my previous one on women's travel writing in Canada, they're all about issues related to gender, culture, position in Canadian women's writing. Mm-hmm. And so so I do see them as connected to one another. What I've noticed about my current research during the pandemic is that while the pandemic changed some things really, you know, quite intensely, like the conference, and other things like a conference that I was supposed to be presenting a keynote at in Europe that was canceled postponed in the fall. So it changed some things, and also it made it impossible for me to actually travel to do research or travel to present papers. But it did actually, strangely enough, open up some opportunities. And I think it's because of my research topic, which is on apocalyptic dystopian fiction, which includes pandemic fiction, of course. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of calls for papers specifically on pandemics in literature that I was able to answer, one in a journal and one in a conference. And so it gave me the opportunity to write essays on recent pandemic literature that I was planning on writing anyway at some point. But they included essays on Emily St. John Mandel's Station 11 and Salima Nawaz's Songs for the End of the World. Both of those books focus in really important ways, not just on pandemics, but on how literary culture helps us to navigate issues related to apocalyptic events such as pandemics. So I've actually found the pandemic, although, you know, in some ways it's closed down possibilities, that it's actually opened up lots of other possibilities and made some really fruitful time for doing work on my area of apocalyptic fiction in Canada.
So. Mm-hmm. For sure. Okay, well, I just want to give you a big thank you for coming on the podcast and for sharing the launch with us. This episode was recorded on Treaty 6 territory and the homeland of the Métis. The conversations I had with Wendy about her book preparation process have had me thinking about different resources I've used and encountered myself, especially as a white settler scholar working here on Treaty 6, who in general reads and researches and writes and teaches and thinks about literatures written and published on Treaty 6, but also beyond in the territories called Canada. And that includes Indigenous literature that's published and written here on these lands. And for me, my research, or maybe more so my writing process, has been enriched by a resource that I want to share with you if you don't already know about it. Elements of Indigenous Style, a guide for writing by and about Indigenous peoples, written by the late Greg Younging, who was a Cree scholar and professor and a publisher and an editor and etc., etc., who had many different roles and was involved in so many different communities of thinking and researching and writing and publishing. Let me read the description of the book from the publisher's website. Elements of Indigenous Style offers Indigenous writers and editors, and everyone creating works about Indigenous peoples, the first published guide to common questions and issues of style and process. Everyone working in words or other media needs to read this important new reference and to keep it nearby while they're working. This guide features 22 succinct style principles, advice on culturally appropriate publishing practices, including how to collaborate with Indigenous peoples, when and how to seek the advice of elders, and how to respect Indigenous oral traditions and traditional knowledge, terminology to use and to avoid, advice on specific editing issues such as biased language, capitalization, and quoting from historical sources and archives, and case studies of projects that illustrate best practices. I'll link to where you can find the book in the show notes. If I can say more directly to other white settlers, especially researchers who might be listening and who work in academia, or maybe who work in media and journalism and education, also in business and community organizations, get a copy of this book. Read it, learn from it, and use it as a resource and a reference book. Thank you to Diella Swain for the podcast music. You can find more of their work at soundcloud.com/DiellaS. That's DiellaS. Thank you to Jade McDougall at muskrat-hands.com for the awesome podcast graphics. You can follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at teachinbookspod, no G, or get in touch via email at teachinbookspod@gmail.com. All right, thank you for listening, and goodbye for now, but please join me again next week on Teachin' Books.